In the early 70s, the Sonny and Cher Comedy Hour was a primetime TV staple. The real-life couple, Sonny and Cher Bono, dressed up in outrageous Bob Mackie-designed outfits, performed corny skits, and sang medleys with their campy celebrity friends.
But at the height of their TV success, the couple called it quits, and Cher launched her own musical variety show, The Cher Show. Decades later, The Cher Show is back as a new musical that looks at the pop diva's amazing career. Today, Cher enthusiast Damon L. Jacobs joins us to take a look at The Cher Show that's playing in Chicago before hitting Broadway this fall.
I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun. If I could turn back time. Oh, hi, everyone. This is Cher. Welcome to my musical, The Cher Show. Oh.
Wait, I'm Cher too.
We're all Cher.
I'm the young Cher.
I'm the middle Cher.
I'm the Nadia Ginsburg Cher, also known as the old Cher. The Cher Show is currently being developed here in Chicago, a musical about the great goddess Cher. What's her full Cher's full name?
Sherilyn Sarkisian.
Can you do it slower?
Sherilyn Sarkisian.
Sherilyn Sarkisian.
Bodo Allman.
Allman.
Allman,
yeah. Yes.
They did get married, right?
Yeah, she did marry Greg Allman.
And so it's Broadway bound right now, but right now they're, just like Cher's face, they're reworking it in Chicago.
It's a transition.
It's directed by Jason Moore, who is best known for his work in directing and originating Avenue Q.
Which is a great show as well.
Fantastic. The book is written by Jersey Boys Tony Award winner Rick Ellis, and has, of course, costumes by the legendary designer Bob Mackie, who collaborated with Cher over years on her looks, dating back to her 1967 appearance on the Carol Burnett Show.
Yes.
Today, we are taking you guys behind the scenes on the Cher Show musical that is destined to probably win, at the very least, a Tony Award for Best Costumes. Joining us is family therapist and prep provocateur Damon L. Jacobs.
And Cher fanatic.
And Cher fanatic, most importantly.
Because you came to town just to see us and to see Cher.
Yes, this was a mixing of three of my favorite things, which is Cher, theater, and you two.
Okay.
So it was a perfect bliss for me to be with there, to be with you two and to see the show together.
And it was really exciting to see the show with you because you were so into it. You really, really enjoyed it.
And that's the Cher-laid.
It's mesmerizing.
That's why I appreciate people's enthusiasm for stuff because it's infectious. You know, it really is. It made it much more of an experience. I was sitting between you and this other woman, and she loved the show too. I was just like, I'm getting all the feels from it.
Oh, yeah. Well, you guys know, and long-term listeners of your show know that Cher makes so much of who I am today. Why I came out of the closet when I was 17 years old was because she won the Academy Award for Moonstruck. And the night that she won, she had done an interview with Barbara Walters, because Barbara Walters used to do these shows before, or on the West Coast it was after. And she said to Barbara Walters was like, people didn't take you seriously. People have always laughed at you. Didn't that upset you? Didn't that hurt you? And Cher said, you know, it did hurt my feelings when Silkwood came out and people laughed at me. But then I just realized that who I am is not going to be determined by other people. And this is not a dress rehearsal. I don't get a second chance to do this. So I'm going to do everything I can on the first try. And that to me was just like a siren call for coming out of the closet. And I think a lot of gays have had that experience with Cher to say she can be who she is. People laugh at her. People mock her. People don't understand her. But she just keeps on brazenly being who she is. And if she can do it, I can do it too.
You know, it's interesting. You touched on that, people mocking her when she got into Silkwood. And I remember that. But it was it's hard for younger people, I think, to imagine that there was a point in time where Cher was a bit of a joke.
She was
She literally had a variety show where she made jokes. She was seen as much as a comedian as a singer in her heyday when she had the Sonny and Cher Show, and then later on had the Cher Show.
And the show was just silly.
The show was silly, but also, too, in some ways it was kind of interpreted as a flop in some ways, right?
her TV show.
Not ratings wise.
So there were three incarnations, and they didn't distinguish that in the Broadway in the show we saw last night. It was the original Sonny and Cher show, which was a huge hit for CBS. Yeah. I mean,
top five show, huge
big hit. Yeah. Then there was the Cher show just by herself, which I think did okay. Mm-hmm. And then they got back together to do the Sonny and Cher show reboot while she was married to Greg Allman and pregnant with Elijah. Mm-hmm. And America did not go for that. That one flopped really bad, and that one was canceled.
And then why was she a joke at the time of Silkwood coming out?
Well, because she was so silly. I mean, she had done this variety show very successfully, but America did not and still does not respect strong women. They didn't understand how a woman could be funny and sexy, but still could be extremely talented and have depth in her work. And that was what she faced when she got into Silkwood. And she did that role as a lesbian named Meryl Streep's roommate in Silkwood, and she went pretty much without makeup, and this was pre-plastic surgery.
I believe it was in Silkwood.
Or
bisexual. They had a romantic sexual relationship.
They had a very intimate relationship, but not a sexual, at least not in the film. Mm-hmm. Their characters did not have a sexual relationship. And that was very brave. I mean, she went very anti-Cher. She did a very dramatic role with very real emotions, crying, feeling dismissed, feeling hurt. And she did most of it without makeup while losing her best friend to cancer.
And what's funny is she was playing a makeup artist in the movie.
Just to clarify, Cher did play a lesbian character, but she was not in a relationship with Meryl Streep's character.
Right. They were not in a relationship. She had a relationship with Christina Crawford in Silkwood. The Diane Scarwood, who had played Christina Crawford in Mommy Dearest, did Silkwood after that, and she was Cher's lover in Silkwood.
What was interesting about is that Cher in that movie, she was going to cosmetology school, and she was going to do corpses, and she made over Meryl Streep in it, and the boyfriend's like, well, how do you think I look? He's like, I think you look like a dead corpse.
She makes over Cher's character.
Yeah.
She makes over Polly.
Oh, is that how it goes?
Yeah. She makes over Cher's character and
so when we heard wind that they were developing a musical based on the Cher show, there was a lot of speculation by our friends and the theater blogs in Chicago that the Cher show did not have direct involvement with Cher. And in fact, because Cher doesn't own the rights to a lot of her music, just the recordings, obviously, she doesn't own the rights to the Cher show neither. And so it was actually Bob Mackie that was the driving force behind this. And if you think about it, Bruce Valanche, who's a former guest of the show as well, he is as much a part of the Cher show as Cher herself or Bob Mackie. He's not a character in this musical, but Bob Mackie is probably one of the top billed characters. And there's a good sequence dedicated to his designs, which is extraordinary to watch and worth the price of the admission.
Absolutely. That was a beautiful part of the show. And definitely their bid for being nominated for the Tony, as you mentioned.
So a lot of people are asking us, should I go see this here in Chicago?
I'd say there are no shoulds.
Okay. Well, would I enjoy seeing this? And my advice to you is, if you're a Cher fan, absolutely go see it, because you will be very satisfied. But even if you're just a fan of popular culture, if you're a fan of musicals, or you just enjoy seeing great costume design and great I would describe the dancing in the show as basically Disney theme park on the level of complexity. Certainly the musical arrangements are not anything extraordinary, and considering that they're based on Cher's actual hits, they're in some ways simplified for the theatrical audience. It was really nice and refreshing to be able to really hear the lyrics, because the way Cher sings, she kind of brays their note. She sings off the side of her mouth. And so seeing three actresses playing Cher, all singing in that same kind of way, all at the same time, was almost got to a point that it was a caricature of Cher and it made us suspend our suspension of disbelief. And so it got me out of my seat. But regardless of this, I describe it to people as a Disney ride where you know exactly what's going to happen and everything you expect happens, and you're still very satisfied at the end of the ride and you're a little wet, just like Splash Mountain.
And I think for the gay audience, for me, this was like going to Disneyland. Mm-hmm. It was a wonderful, immersive experience, knowing whatever happens on that stage, it's even if it's horrible, it's going to be great. And I'm in this theater where everybody is all there for the same reason, because we love Cher, because we all want to be entertained. We all want to support this work, and we just want to experience this adventure of her life that she contributed to.
I'd say we all loved it. The only one person who didn't love it was Cher herself. I guess she showed up last week and said, you know, I like it, but there's some things that need to be reworked. And, you know, because there are some things that it's a little awkward sometimes. It's a little tacky at times. It's a little weird. But, you know, part of that is like, that's Cher.
Well, so let's talk about the things that could have, that I hope they do rework before it goes to Broadway. Because as much as now, so we've established I'm a Cher fanatic, and it's not even like I'm a fanatic, because that would suggest that we're separate. We're not separate. We're like the same, you know.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, there's certain things that didn't work for me, or we're struggling in the show. And that was that you have these three women playing Cher, and that's fine. Because you think, okay, they're going to be playing these different chronological stages
there's
of her
young
life.
Cher, there's middle-aged Cher, and then there's Nadia Ginsburg Cher.
The senior Cher, who kind of takes over in the early 1980s and
she's
really takes
dominant
charge.
Voice.
Kind of the Cher that a lot of us really have come to know, that bold, bodacious, brazen Cher. But what doesn't really work right now theatrically is how the three of them continue to interact with each other throughout the entire show. Except, now, spoiler alert, because this is not, I'm going to just talk about something that happens at the end, because I think at the end, it's really tied well together. At the end, you realize that these three Chers are not chronological incarnations as much as they are emotional incarnations. They are psychologically different parts of Cher at three different stages of her life. And when you look at the play, and this is why I hope if people see it, I hope they correct this. And if they don't, at least see the play, knowing that these three Chers are more about different developmental stages than they are chronological ages. And if you can see it from that point of view, it makes a lot more sense. This is child Cher working with adult Cher. This is, you know, Sonny and Cher, the middle, the 60s and 70s
Cher. So it's like codependent Cher.
Well, her set, so that was the middle one was kind of portrayed that way.
Yeah.
You know, she was also very afraid, and she was still being controlled by Sonny. But they use these different Chers to resolve problems and crises at different stages of her life.
Because they interact with each other.
They interact with each other.
It's like my inner child is telling me, an adult woman, like, this is what you have to remember because this is who you are. And then they're trying to be like, you need to be strong, that kind of stuff.
And they step in for each other in a way. It's almost like, for those who saw Sense8 on Netflix.
Sure.
They had these different, you know, they were all different portions of the same energy, and they stepped in for each other and helped each other in different crises. That's what I started to feel like the Cher show was feeling like. It was only these three, but they would step in and help each other when one of them was in stress. So they did trace it chronologically, but I feel like the three Chers speak to developmental stages more than they do to the chronology.
Right.
And I got more out of it when I saw it in that way.
In that respect, yeah. That makes sense.
It's a common theatrical technique when you have a musical that's based on a singular person, like the Love, Janice is another example, where you have different actors playing the same character at different points in their life. And part of Mommy Dearest, the film, sort of does that with Christina Crawford, right?
The two Christinas. Yeah.
But the reason that you do that in a musical is just because, you know, the toll on one person's voice can be extreme. And so when you split it up into three people, it makes it easier if somebody has a cold or somebody is not, you know, able to play that role. It's not such a disaster to swap them out with somebody else.
Well, and all the costume changes, too.
Sure.
It was just a pragmatic thing.
It's
you
practical.
Can't have that many people. You can't have Cher talking about the Academy Awards and then have the same Cher wearing the outfit. You have to have different Chers.
Doesn't Cher do that in her own concerts, though? Doesn't she, like, walk behind something and she comes out in a whole new outfit?
She changes within 90 seconds of her show that she's currently doing in Vegas. She will do, like, she'll walk out on stage and then go away for like 90 seconds and come back in a completely different outfit.
And I think that's an important thing to, you know, consider there. In terms of, like, the people who are listening to this at the home, you know, because we're all very excited about the show. And so sometimes when we're talking about theater, it's important to keep in mind that people are listening. And what kind of questions have you felt that people are asking you about the Cher show that you'd like to answer right now?
Well, I think people want to know if it's worth it. You know, theater is expensive, so is it worth it? And like you said, if you're a Cher fan, absolutely. I still think there's, even if you are sort of a Cher fan, or you just really appreciate theater, or you appreciate American culture, this is still worth seeing. The one thing that I, so after the show last night, and as I was drifting to sleep, because I think about Cher too much, but it struck me that there were parallels to this show and The Wizard of Oz. And so, and I will explain why. There's the theme at the beginning where she is being bullied as a child. And she's feeling like there's got to be somewhere else. She starts in El Centro, California, and she's being bullied for being dark skin. You know, she's half breed, quote unquote. And her mom and her have this talk about that there's something out there better for her. There's a world out there that's better for her. And then she goes into the world and she meets Sonny Bono, who represents, in my mind, if we're going to draw allusions to The Wizard of Oz, he kind of represents the Tin Man so much that he is very, very smart, but he is portrayed as often very heartless. And then she goes on and she meets Greg Allman, who pretty much has no brain. At least the way he's portrayed in the show, he is like, he's like the Scarecrow character. He is very loving towards her, but he has no brain and he's very self-destructive. And then she goes on to hang out with Rob. And he, a portion of the show is defined by her relationship with Rob.
He's the Italian that she dated in the 80s.
Camelotti, I think. And he is very he's thoughtful and he's feeling, but he lacks a certain ability to deal with the pressures of fame and eventually has to back away. And he kind of reminded me of the Cowardly Lion in that part. And that might sound judgmental, but I think he represents that he just couldn't see it through. He just couldn't be part of that. He had to walk away from that. And then so she goes through these three people and these three relationships. And ultimately, the message at the end of the show, spoiler alert, is pretty much there's no place like home. Her mom is like, you've always had home. You've always been loving. You've always been deserving of beauty.
She didn't
and
always have a home, though. Her mother gave her up for adoption.
But and I wish they had touched on that, because I think the theme would have meant so much more if they had touched on the fact that her mother had given her up to an orphanage for like a year of her life when she was 3 years old, and how traumatizing that was to her. But the theme at the very end is there's no place like home. And then they say, sing Take Me Home. And that was when I cried, because that was the part that kind of the whole show tied together for me emotionally and what they were trying to say and how they were trying to say it.
So are you saying that like Bob Mackie is like the Munchkins? Or she's Glinda the Good Witch?
I have to think about his role.
Well, this is the thing about the Cher show, right? Normally in these kind of celebrity driven musicals, we see a lot of the people in their lives portrayed in the film, in the stage adaptation of their lives or their memoirs or and so on. And it would make sense, and I really like the Cher show, that they start bringing the camera guy and the director and the sound person and Bob Mackie, who directed, you know, he was somebody who, we were talking about this, he sort of, because of the need of the musical variety show, he started giving Cher all these different iconic looks that were at the time very scandalous because of the way they revealed her body. And in unwittingly, Bob Mackie created the reinvention of the pop star. He invented the reinvention, and out of necessity, and because he also was an unapologetic gay man for his time and of the day, the Cher show is as much a tribute to Bob Mackie's design genius as it is to Cher. And if you're a fan of popular culture and LGBT culture, you owe it yourself to go see this musical because of that sequence. And it is something to see the real outfits, those real costumes, down to the thread detail in person is something, you know, I hope someday the Smithsonian Museum is able to have a Cher costume showcase like this. Well, but until that day comes, this is as close as you're going to get.
Well, I think that's interesting, too, and she even points it out during the show, is like oftentimes he came up with the costume and then the sketch that they did for the show and the jokes came because of that costume. That was the inspiration for much of it. And it's interesting to see how fashion can influence comedy.
And it was great sort of being in the audience and seeing all these kind of senior gay men seeing what their own celebrated, and to the point that I was like, are you Bob Mackie? He's like, no, I'm just an old guy in a good suit.
That's true. You thought you saw Bob Mackie. I thought it was Bob Mackie. I didn't really know what he looked like, but I don't think it was him.
I would, if I got in an elevator with Bob Mackie, I would definitely, he was a judge on RuPaul's Drag Race, so people who are familiar with earlier seasons would recognize him. But, he has a gentle, sweet, kind personality, which is very refreshing for somebody of his prestige and his background as a designer. Most, if you see The Incredibles, designers have this reputation of being, temper tantrum auteurs who are always demanding the best and not settling for anything else, and Bob Mackie certainly, comes across as a very similar to Stanley Tucci's character in Burlesque, as kind of Cher's wingman to help in guiding her through the peril-filled world of entertainment.
And they certainly show how he helped her in other stages of her life, when she left the Sonny and Cher show, the first incarnation, mm-hmm. how scary that was for her. But she was able to do that partly because of Bob Mackie, because she knew she could still rely on him for those outfits, that she could do the Cher show by herself, because it was pretty much the Bob Mackie show. And that's what America was tuning into, was to see her amazing, mm-hmm. scandalous dresses that they kept pushing the censors every single week.
I remember being a kid, and I'll never forget it. She was wearing some kind of dress, and Sonny asked about it, because it was this tight dress, and then it came up over one, the fabric came over one boob around her neck, and then came down the other side and clutched her other boob. And I remember her describing it. She goes, "I feel like my boob's in like a pile of tin foil." Or she probably said aluminum foil. Maybe it was tin foil, because it was, that was the 70s. I think they still called it tin foil.
Much like Cher's face, they're reworking mm-hmm. this musical. And when I had talked to friends who had seen it originally in the first week, there was no use of "If I Could Turn Back Time" at the very beginning, right?
Yeah.
It would make total sense to do that. Now it is there.
And you predicted that on this show. I've heard you predict that they were going to start that show with
It's a good idea, and it's good sense, right? And I'm so used to being disappointed and going to see a play or show that doesn't just say, what are the expectations of the audience? What would make sense to put in the beginning? They're always like, I'm going to have this weird, obscure song. So they had a lot more of obscure music from Cher's catalog, which didn't play well so much with the audience. The audience is there to see the hits, to hear the hits. So that was really satisfying, that in the first 30 minutes of the show, you get 95% of Cher's hits packed back to back. There's also discussion that a lot of her songs from Burlesque, which even if you hate this movie, it still has a lot of her very important songs, like You Haven't Seen the Last of Me. And so they bring that into the show. So it's really great to see all of Cher, from The Beat Goes On to I Got You, Babe, all the way up to the modern day, all jam-packed in this roller coaster ride through her life. It's very, very satisfying, and that's why we're dedicating a mm-hmm. whole show to Cher.
They even had a song from her last album in 2013, the song her mom sings to her, I Hope You Find It. It's a slow ballad at the very mm-hmm. end, and that was from her last new album mm-hmm. of new material.
Because her mom's still singing, right?
Yeah, her mom's still singing. Her mom's still alive. And she came out with an album in, 2013.
Didn't they record something in the 80s? And they're they just kind of sat on it?
Her mom was a singer, and I guess she had done a bunch of songs with Elvis Presley's band that just got thrown in a garage somewhere.
Oh, wow.
So as a gift to her, Cher recreated the songs with a new band, and her mom sang them, and that came out as an album at the end of mm-hmm. 2013 or 14.
But there was something, I think they had been holding on to some tapes for, 20 years or something. Something like that, and then they released something. It was it was quite incredible. What did you think of her mom as a character in the show?
I wanted to see more of her.
You and Cher both?
Yeah, Cher has said that too. That the mother, again, really for me, sort of fulfilled the mm-hmm. good witch. Mm-hmm. So she's kind of, she drops in here or there mm-hmm. when Cher's kind of in a crisis mm-hmm. and needs a little mm-hmm. Love and support. Yeah. And I think
she's totally the good witch, Glinda.
The show would work better with her more as a fully fleshed out character. And she's a woman in real life who is very strong, but admittedly has had a lot of faults, including mm-hmm. not being able to support her child, which is why she put her in an orphanage mm-hmm. when she was 3 years old.
I think it's interesting, too, is that when they mention Cher's child, Chaz, they refer to him as Chaz, even though at the time Chaz would have identified as somebody else.
As female.
As female.
It was assigned female at birth.
Right.
And so it it was sort of revisionist history, referring to a trans person in the past before they had come out as by another gender than they currently associate today with.
Unless they always called him Chaz.
I'm pretty sure Cher used to call Chaz Chaz.
Okay.
Even before he transitioned.
Okay.
I vaguely remember, like, Phil Donahue. So one of the interviews that Sonny Bono was really upset about was an interview she did on the Phil Donahue show in, like, 1985, where she talked about his abuse, and she talked about an abuser. And she mentioned, I think there, in a lot of that time, she called Chastity Chaz. Okay. I think that was always sort of a nickname.
Oh, okay. Because I was just kind of, I remember turning like, oh, they got that right.
Yeah. Disney Aladdin's Michael Graceffa, who played one of the sexy Arabian Nights.
Arabian Nights.
The hunky Charlie Williams. And these are all people you should follow on Instagram. Taron Everett. And, you know, Cher's backup dancers and this Cher show, honey, are worthy of legendary sex appeal. As Lady Bunny, can I make the Lady Bunny joke? What happened to all those hot dancers? They died from AIDS. What? You slept with all of them? Oh, Bunny. But these are some, you know, the backup dancer for the Cher show in the time period were these hunky, gorgeous, beautiful gay men. And through the wisdom of the producers, they cast openly gay dancers who are very visually appealing and very beautiful on stage as Cher's sort of entourage throughout the whole play.
Well, they know their audience. One of them is practically naked in the Bob Mackie scene, if you recall.
Mm-hmm.
One of the men comes out as in Cher in the Indian outfit. Mm-hmm. Pretty
that
much
was Taron Everett.
Yeah. Yes.
So they cast the African-American guy to wear the Indian outfit, so maybe it wouldn't be as controversial.
Maybe.
Because people still kind of look at Cher with that Indian outfit with a little bit of like, that's culture appropriation. At the time, it flew in the 70s, but it's like, would Cher do that now? I don't think she would.
But she was speaking to her experience, and I hope people understand that in context. Mm. When Half Breed came out, I think that was 1972, and that was her story. That was her story. But yes, the video, and they did videos for that back then, was this big Bob Mackie gown where she's practically naked and she's wearing a big Cherokee feather and she's riding a horse. But that was her statement. That's what she was expressing about herself and her experience at that time.
Because I don't actually believe that she is Cherokee.
She's not.
Her father was Armenian, and I thought half Cherokee. We could easily... John Sarkeesian. She talked about this.
Okay. Oh, let's Google this. Is
John Sarkeesian was partly Cherokee and Armenian?
Native American or not? No, you are not part Cherokee. Well, this is how conservatives are trying to discredit her.
I think Georgia, her mom is... But her dark skin came from her father.
So, according to various sources on the internet, which may or may not be true, her mother claimed to have some Cherokee roots.
Okay.
And Cher may have believed her. Many white people, especially in Arkansas, where their mother was from, and Oklahoma, have family stories like this. Most are not true, though.
Hmm.
We do not know for sure or not if Cher's mother's story is true, but the odds are that they are not.
We have to get her to do a 23andMe test.
I don't think Cher's doing that.
I have a question for you two.
Mm-hmm.
So the very first part of the show, there's a question that she gets asked, and I thought of you two at this time. Someone says to her, "You've been doing this for so long. Why do you still do this?" And a lot of the show is explaining why she still does this. And I was thinking how you two have done Feast of Fun beautifully for 14 years. But sometimes, you know, like, why do you still do this?
I'll tell you the answer.
Were there any metaphors in the Cher show?
Yeah, it's a little secret. No one actually listens to the show. But this is an opportunity for me to get alone time with my husband and actually interact with him.
What? We'll pay attention to him half the time.
Why do we do this, Mark? What is the podcast mean to you?
Well, it's a wonderful way to interact with people, and it's a way to talk about ideas and have conversations and to inform and entertain. And it's about making that bond with the audience. And I think that that's really at the root of it. And Cher talks about going out there and feeling like that wave of love. And she keeps getting those waves. And you feel that in the audience, especially when somebody makes a donation at feastfund.com/donate.
Or becomes a premium subscriber and listens to the past shows, mm-hmm. 14 years of shows at feastoffun.com/plus.
I love that you now have guys coming up to you and saying, I grew up watching you, listening to your show.
Yeah. We've got kids that were 13, 14 that were listening to the show, and now they're approaching 30. It's crazy.
Wow.
Well, I've always, since the age of 18, I've been interviewing people as an artist, as a performer, as a journalist. And now I'm 29 years old, and I'm still doing that this day. And part of me, it's something that I have very feel much a passion and a vocation for it. Seeing the Mr. Rogers documentary, Won't You Be My Neighbor? I very much feel a close kinship to Mr. Rogers. And as a child, I would watch Mr. Rogers, and then most kids be like, okay, yeah, get to the puppets, Rogers. Get to the land of make-believe. Quit flapping your boogers. Let's see Daniel Tiger. Oh, yeah, baby. That's the sweet stuff. Show me that tiger puppet. I love that tiger puppet. Meow, meow is a kitty. Meow, meow. You know. So, but I feel that Mr. Rogers, in a lot of ways, for me, was a surrogate grandfather. A kind, benevolent figure in my early childhood who, one way or another, guided me to do the humanistic, if you want to describe the work that I do today. And I'm also equally influenced by someone like Studs Terkel, who's a Chicago broadcast legend. Mm-hmm. It's the idea behind all this is that the ordinary person, the everyday person, doesn't need to do anything extraordinary to be worthy of receiving love. And equally, ordinary people can actually be very compelling and fascinating just by talking about their feelings. And when we are able to put people in front of these microphones or in front of these cameras, and when they're able to connect with a deeper sense of themselves, we are able to make the world a much better place because we're able to illuminate a light onto people that normally get ignored. Mm-hmm. So when we started interviewing drag queens for the vast majority of our lives in this project, there was no drag race. People didn't care about drag queens. Logo told us in a meeting, we don't do content based on drag queens. Mm. We say no to drag queens. We find drag queens to be offensive and problematic.
And that's why we love them.
And to me, it's like, and Mark says this really well, drag queens are, in a lot of ways, our entertainers. They're our artists for our community. And thankfully, now we live in a world where that's no longer the case, that drag queens are certainly one of the most sought after interviews and certainly one of the most bankable entertainers there are. And so in some ways, we were a little too successful at illuminating that demographic. So in the years to come, what I'd like to do is to continue to explore our community and try to understand and illuminate people who are not celebrated and not viewed. So to me, it's like right now, I guess I would say I'm still going to do stuff with Drag Race, but, you know, especially after this season, I felt there was a lot of negativity. There was a lot of false binaries, right? It's this idea that you're either for the Vixen or for RuPaul. And I'm like, ¿por qué no los dos? Why not have both? We can create space for everybody to be understood and heard, and at the same time have people to be thankful for anything that they receive. Because ultimately, we're stronger as a community together than we are when we walk out of the room.
That's beautiful. That's beautifully stated.
You know.
That was like your version of Believe. I want to write lyrics to that.
Actor who played Rob Camilletti Lee, yeah. Michael Campaio, forgive me, Michael, if I mispronounced your name. I felt that what to me was the emotional highlight of the musical was him actually singing, this is a different kind of love song.
Mm-hmm.
And back to this idea that we are deserving of love just because we're here. And ask yourself, listener, if you're listening, ask yourself this question. Am I curious about the emotional well-being about the people in my life? Am I asking people that I work with, my family, my friends, my husband, my wife, how are you really doing? How, creating space for them to talk about their feelings. If you're not doing that, you might want to ask yourself why you're not doing that. And I think that at the core of what I learned about the Cher Show musical is that when we can create those kind of spaces for people, we can overcome anything. Mm. Hashtag Trump. Suck it.
We're That's fuck the next Trump. Episode.
That's the next episode.
You're coming back for tomorrow's show. We're going to talk about how to survive 45.
Oh,
survive
yeah.
45,
oh,
baby.
Yeah. Well, that's beautiful, Foster. And I agree. I mean, you guys do. You gave me a platform before anyone else did. You've supported
I
my work for 10
every
years.
Every day of
good.
That.
Good.
I'm just kidding. Well, so for people who may not be familiar with your work, you're certainly an early advocate of PrEP.
Mm-hmm.
And PrEP is a course of medical medication where people's bodies become 95, 98, effective to prevent 99.
Higher.
99.
Higher
point,
than 99.
Like ivory
pretty
soap.
Pretty much close to 90. Pretty as close to 100%
effective
as you can medically
to
get.
To preventing HIV infections.
Right.
The AIDS Foundation of Chicago this year have announced that their goal is to have zero conversion rates.
Wow, good.
Zero new HIV infections in the city of Chicago.
Good.
That's,
you know,
their goal.
As long as I've been working in this profession, which was in 1991, we've thrown around these slogans like get to zero or ending the epidemic or be the generation. We've never had the tools to do it until
right.
now. So when the AIDS Foundation of Chicago. When they say things like that, when San Francisco talks about getting to zero, or New York talks about getting to zero, this is the first time that that is an actual goal that can actually be met based on the tools available to us.
Sure.
We know that PrEP prevents HIV. We know that if someone's living with HIV and they're undetectable for 6 months or longer, they cannot transmit HIV to others. So when we put these tools together, that's where we see these getting to zero numbers that are happening in the major cities. Now, the trick is getting this to happen outside the major cities. Because we're not going to end the HIV epidemic if it's just limited to Chicago and New York and San Francisco. But we are on a really good track here. And that is why I get so excited about talking about that.
Well, if we're really serious about stopping the epidemic, we need to give people in prisons PrEP.
Absolutely.
And until that happens, we will not be able to effectively stop that.
Absolutely. The
a
World
lot of
Health
new
Organization,
HIV infections yeah. come from people being in prison.
Absolutely. The World Health Organization, the CDC does not yeah. acknowledge that, but the World Health Organization does. They consider prison population to be at, quote, substantial risk of becoming HIV positive. And it is their recommendations that prison populations are offered PrEP as a way to prevent HIV. But you know how that goes in the real world, how that flies.
Well, and I was thinking about this because I've always said that, like, abortion, you know, is a political football for conservatives to or corrupt politicians to be able to stay in power. They're really not, obviously, like, the Republican Party doesn't give two shits about children. They're putting children in cages right now in concentration camps. They lie about saying they were reuniting families when they're not really doing any of that. So them as being concerned about the welfare of infants or children is a lie. I think with this circumstance is they're interested in curbing people from having sex. Any kind of resistance to giving people PrEP is really sort of the same reason why we don't want to give women access to contraceptives or to abortion, is they can't stand the idea of somebody somewhere having sex that they enjoy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sex for pleasure is really scary to a lot of people.
Mm. Yeah. And that's what at the core of all that.
Yeah.
But where does that come from? Does it come from sexual violence? Does it come from people just not having sex so they don't want other people to have it? Like, what is it?
I think it's more, I think that's the psychological part, is more people who aren't having the kind of sex that they want to have. And so they get really, really pissed off if you are having the kind of sex that they want to have.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it is moral. This country is all about religion, morality. And a lot of it's just homophobia and fear of the butt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're a society that's really scared of shit. And when you're talking about anal sex and pleasure, you're talking about the possibility of there being fecal matter, and that scares a lot of people. So that makes them a little grossed out to the point where they don't want to talk about it, they don't want to deal with it, mm-hmm. and they certainly don't want to help anybody else be able to enjoy fucking without condoms and take many loads of cum up their ass. It's so interesting, though. I was talking to an anthropologist in Australia the other day, and we were talking about historically the rites of semen in many, many religious rituals throughout time.
What?
Yes. That semen is, go back to ancient Greece.
The anthropological value of ejaculate.
Of ejaculate, that men's semen has been considered to be a source of health and nourishment and even a rite of passage for youth over different cultures over time. Ooh. And I'm not saying that would work in 2018 anywhere, but I am saying...
Yeah, I don't think grandpa's sperm...
I am saying that talking about exchanging semen with another man as a man does have a historical context to it.
Sure.
That for me personally, that is a very emotional and spiritual experience that I value greatly. And that's part of my enthusiasm for talking about PrEP, is because for me, this is a rewarding experience. And if someone else wants to have this experience, and mm-hmm. I know a lot of people do from my Facebook mm-hmm. group... that this is an opportunity that we have now mm-hmm. to do that using the medical scientific tools available to us.
So you're becoming an advocate for PrEP because it's allowing you to have the kind of sex you want to have.
I did other way around.
What?
I started having the kind of sex I really want to have.
Okay.
And then I was like, oh, I want everyone to know about this. I want everyone to be able to enjoy this because this is great.
Applause.
And so I started this Facebook group, which is just past 5 years old. Yeah. So it's been 5 years
and
moderating this group.
Now?
We now have over 21,200 international members.
And every day there's somebody who's saying, like, what about the side effects?
What about this? What about that? Because what I learned...
My friend went to a bathhouse, had five sex with five different guys, but he missed a dose.
And what I've learned from that is that you can take away fear of HIV, but you can't take away fear. That undoing fear when it comes to sex is mm-hmm. a much, much, much deeper process mm-hmm. than I even thought. And mm-hmm. So what we see every day in the Facebook group is that people are kind of understanding PrEP now, mm-hmm. but they still register synaptically in their minds. They still register fucking with fear.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that's going to take a lot more time to change.
Especially our age group, we grew up where it's like, gay sex equal death. So in many ways, you were afraid of it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I grew up with silence equals death.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it was really wonderful this Pride season to seeing lots of gender nonconforming young people wearing ACT UP merch from way back. I was like, where are you guys buying this stuff?
Probably it's like from Adam at Adam's Nest.
I'm surprised.
But Adam Singer, a very special person to me at Adam's Nest, has been selling the Silence Equals Death shirts. He revived them in 2016 with the blessing of the Avram Finkelstein, who created the shirt. And they have been selling really well because
and
a lot
the
of kids
proceeds
don't
of those
know.
Shirts go to?
Oh, God, Housing Works. That one got no. Okay. Because there's different organizations.
Sure.
He's
actually donating
that one goes
the
to Housing Works. 10% of those proceeds go to Housing Works.
Okay.
He also donates to Planned Parenthood and the ACLU.
I know Grand Fury, brilliant. We talked about Bob Mackie, another group of brilliant gay designers. And that's that's a show worth doing, Mark, isn't it? Is a show about the amazing, legendary, groundbreaking contributions of gay male designers.
Let's do it.
Because I think, Grand Fury and Bob Mackie are two, and the beat goes on, and the beat goes on.
And it matters, because as kids, I didn't know who Bob Mackie was, right? We didn't have internet, we didn't have cable. So Bob Mackie was so influential in my life in ways I didn't know. But it was Cher who was out there. She was the one wearing the outfits. She was the one dishing out the attitude. She was the one, mm-hmm. at even 5 years old, giving me the courage to say, I don't have to conform or fit in with other kids. It's okay to be different. It's okay to be weird. You can kind of be the outsider and still be beautiful and successful. And I think that's part of why I get the courage to talk about PrEP the way I've been doing the last 6 years and to all the other crazy projects I've talked about on your shows in the past is that, I've learned at an early age, partly because of Cher, you don't have to fit in order to be joyful, in order to be happy, in order to be successful. As a matter of fact, being an outsider oftentimes gives you a perspective that allows you to see the world and express the world differently.
If there's a world to survive in, if we survive the Supreme Court, Kennedy resigned. He's bribed by Trump to resign early for a Supreme Court judge. And
he's 80 years old.
He's also, yeah, of course, you know, the fact that Kennedy's son worked for Deutsche Bank, that Kennedy's children are best, thickest thieves with Trump's children, that Trump met with him and practically bribed him and said, you know, if you resign next week, you know, because there's an investigation on me coming right now, I'm going to be able to put a Supreme Court judge with a majority of the Republican Congress that may not be there after November in order to get away with all the crimes that I've done. So certainly Kennedy is being speculated, and certainly your speculation is, as a lot of people are saying, your concern is as Obama said this, your concern is very well founded. Yeah. And so with all the distressful circumstances that are happening in the world today, it's very difficult to see the good in the world. But as Mr. Rogers said, when there's a great catastrophe happening, look for the helpers.
Yep. And look, I think you two are the helpers.
Well, there's helpers everywhere, right? Yeah. And so tomorrow, you're going to be joining us again to talk about how to survive 45, how to cope with stress and strain under the current administration, and why there's always something good that can be done.
Absolutely.
Damon L. Jacobs, thank you for coming on, and thank you for taking us to the Share Show.
It was such a privilege and a joy for me to share with both of you, and it's so great. And
thank
that's
you for
one of the things I'm grateful for. So, brings me happiness.
Appreciates that.
And you know, come back tomorrow.
I will. I'll be
and
back.
We'll talk more. I want to remind folks, we can't do this podcast without you. Support your favorite Feast of Fun podcast by making a donation at feastoffun.com/donate. Mm-hmm.